Hi, and welcome to Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dodson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the proposed NIPSCO rate increase. The Portage Republican Precinct Committee members will elect a new mayor this Saturday. Sharon Jackson reports on a renowned photographer that recently visited the region to capture images of the Indiana Dunes National Park. And Chris Nolte has a conversation with Tammy Silverman of the Indiana Youth Institute. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Gary Councilwoman Rebecca Wyatt sponsored a city resolution Wednesday opposing a proposed NIPSCO rate increase, calling it unfair to Gary residents. The increase would fall mostly on residents, increasing the bill of the average ratepayer by more than 15%. NIPSCO says it needs money to upgrade its infrastructure and transition its power transmission from aging coal-fired facilities, such as the one in Michigan City, to cleaner plants. First District Councilwoman Wyatt said, quote, "I support the efforts that make the generation of electricity cleaner and safer, but not when those costs are borne mostly on the backs of Gary's working families. Big corporations need to step up and pay their fair share." Indianapolis-based Citizens Action Coalition recently noted that the NIPSCO increase, if approved, would raise rates for the average customer 15.1%. Included in that rate would be an increase in the fixed customer charge. The consumer advocacy group points out NIPSCO rates have already increased 30% over the last 10 years, causing additional financial stress to Hoosiers faced with increases in the cost of health care, food, and other necessities. The increase would come in two phases, with the first in September and the second in March 2020. The Indiana Utility Rate Commission, which must approve the increase, is expected to decide this summer. Any increase in electricity rates will come on the heels of a boost in natural gas rates by NIPSCO. The utility began phasing in increases in natural gas rates to its customers last October. Councilwoman Wyatt urges all Gary residents to raise their concerns about the proposed rate increase by attending a public hearing at Hammond High School on Monday, March 11th at 6 p.m. Councilman Wyatt goes on to say, quote, "We need to make ourselves heard on this important issue. Residents need to tell the Indiana Rate Commission that this unfairly targets them." The Gary Common Council is scheduled to discuss Councilman Wyatt's resolution opposing NIPSCO's rate increase on March 5th. If the council votes to pass the resolution, Gary will join East Chicago, Valparaiso, Highland, Schererville, Munster, Griffith, and other cities in Northwest Indiana opposing the rate hike. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. Authorities say an 82-year-old church bus driver is charged with driving while intoxicated after five people were injured when a bus returning from a Chicago Bulls game went off the road in Northwest Indiana. The bus, carrying nearly 50 people, went onto an embankment late Monday along the Indiana Toll Road and passengers were tossed from seats. Police say a 49-year-old man and four children, ages 10 to 14, were taken to hospitals for injuries including head and neck pain. Driver Willie B. Carr of Gary was arrested. A state police spokeswoman said she didn't have information on whether he has a lawyer. The bus is owned by Gary's Jesus Saves Missionary Baptist Church and was returning to Gary from the United Center. You're listening to Lakeshore Update. Authorities say three members of the same family have been found dead, killed in separate homicides within days of each other in Gary. The Lake County Coroner's Office says 69-year-old Wayne Valentine of Fair Oaks was found dead from a gunshot wound Sunday night. The office says his brother, 55-year-old Jimmy Valentine of Gary, was found dead from a gunshot wound Monday afternoon in a ditch. Police say Jimmy Valentine's wife, 48-year-old Tracy Valentine of Hobart, was one of two people found dead February 20th inside a home. The other victim, 55-year-old Timothy Snow of Hammond, was not related to the other victims. Coroners say the cause of their deaths remains under investigation. You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dodson. Governor Eric Holcomb so far is maintaining a poker face as to whether he supports legislation approved this week by the Indiana Senate to relocate the Gary casinos and legalize sports wagering. The Republican chief executive told reporters Wednesday he's just beginning to assess the provisions of Senate Bill 552, which now goes to the House, and plans to keep a close watch on it as the measure continues through the legislative process. The legislation, which passed the Senate 38-11, permits Gary's Majestic Star Casinos to relocate to a new land-based site, likely adjacent to the Borman Expressway, and allows the second Gary gaming license to be used to open a new casino in Terre Haute. The Times reports Holcomb said he's mindful that every change in gaming operations and locations affects every other casino in the state, as well as the revenue relied on by the state and local governments to fund a variety of public amenities. The Senate-approved measure provides some security to Hammond, East Chicago, Michigan City, and LaPorte County through a, quote, hold harmless provision that guarantees those entities would suffer no loss of gaming tax revenue for 3 years following the Gary Casino move, which is likely to initially attract players from the region casinos because of its more accessible location away from Lake Michigan. The governor appeared to be more favorably disposed toward legalizing sports wagering since he said Hoosiers already are betting on professional and college teams through various black market channels. The gaming legislation also is linked to Senate Bill 66, which establishes a state-city compact to oversee the redevelopment of Gary's Buffington Harbor into an intermodal transportation and warehousing center once the Majestic Star casinos are moved elsewhere. Holcomb said his continuing efforts to boost Gary won't directly impact his decision on whether to sign the gaming legislation if the proposal advances to his desk. At the same time, Holcomb cautioned that the proposed water, rail, highway, and air connections at Buffington Harbor need to work in tandem with the existing Port of Indiana at Burns Harbor and not seek to compete with the International Shipping Terminal. Governor Holcomb said, quote, and there's a way to do that. We've got 2 months to make sure we get it right.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The caucus of Portage Republican Precinct Committee members to elect a new mayor will be cut and dry Saturday morning. Councilman John Cannon was the only person to file the necessary paperwork by Wednesday's deadline. Cannon is set to replace convicted former mayor James Snyder. Snyder was found guilty in federal court on February 14th of bribery and tax obstruction charges and is awaiting sentencing. His conviction removed him from office. Since Snyder's conviction, Councilwoman Sue Lynch, Democrat at large, has been acting mayor due to her position as city council president. Lynch and Cannon have been working closely together for the last 2 weeks to run the city. Cannon will fill Snyder's term, which expires December 31st. He is also running for mayor in the November municipal elections. He is uncontested in the primary. Lynch could be his opponent in November. Four Democrats, Lynch, Clerk Treasurer Chris Stidham, City Economic Development Director Annie Maletta, and local realtor Leo Hatch Jr. will face off in the May 7th primary. Once Cannon is formally sworn in as mayor, Republican Party officials will have to set another caucus date to fill his position until year's end on the city council.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb will lead a trade mission to France, Belgium, and Germany beginning next week. Holcomb will be accompanied by Indiana Secretary of Commerce Jim Schillinger, Indiana Economic Development Corp directors John Thompson and Mark Neal, and IEDC staff. The delegation will depart on Wednesday, March 6th, and return on Thursday, March 14th. The IEDC says Indiana is home to 450 European businesses that support more than 113,000 jobs across the state. In 2017, businesses exported $9.6 billion of Indiana-made products to Europe, accounting for more than 25% of the state's total exports. The trip will be Holcomb's third foreign trade mission to Europe and seventh overall as governor. The costs of the trade mission are being paid through private donations to the Indiana Economic Development Foundation.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Governor Eric Holcomb is staying steadfast in his push for a hate crimes bill that includes a list of victim characteristics. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports Holcomb is urging Hoosiers to call their lawmakers to help make that happen.
This session's hate crimes bill originally included a list of victim characteristics, including race, religion, and gender identity. But Senate Republicans struck it out, and House GOP leaders don't support adding it back in. Governor Holcomb says a bill without a list isn't good enough, and he wants Hoosiers to get involved.
They need to contact the legislators that vote their legislator respectfully and appeal to their hearts and minds.
Holcomb says lawmakers could pass a bill that mirrors a federal hate crimes law, which includes a victim characteristics list.
Is not vague. It's very specific. It would be asking every legislator to do nothing that's not already currently in place.
Still, the governor says it's too soon to threaten to veto a bill that doesn't have a list included. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A bill creating a uniform property value assessment passed smoothly through the Senate Tuesday afternoon. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, the legislation aims to help local governments struggling against realtors who want even lower taxes.
The Indiana Farm Bureau says Boone County has spent more than $400,000 on legal costs, fighting big box store chains that appeal property taxes. Bill author Brian Buchanan says he brought his local issue to the State House, hoping to close loopholes in current law and help other communities.
And I will say no one likes paying property taxes, but when we have a property tax system, it's important that we all pay our fair share.
However, Senator Victoria Spartz says she fears the bill's language determining the tax value of a property impacts all businesses, including smaller ones.
This bill not just affects big boxes, it affects everyone, big companies, small companies, moms and pop stores, anyone.
The bill passed 42-7 and now goes to the House, where Buchanan says he plans to keep improving it. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
One of the most significant gaming bills since the industry's beginnings in Indiana easily passed out of the state Senate Tuesday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports the bill will open up a new type of gambling and potentially create a new casino.
The gaming bill allows a Gary casino to move to a more desirable location in the city, away from Lake Michigan. It would also open the door to a new casino in Terre Haute, allow all casinos to give out more free play vouchers, and let racetrack casinos install live dealers for their table games this year. Bill author Mark Messmer says it's a game changer.
A once-in-a-generation opportunity to reset the casino industry in Indiana.
The measure also legalizes sports wagering, including online, though with some limits, says Senator John Ford.
High school sports, amateur sports, and competitive video games cannot be wagered on.
The bill passed 38-11. Some senators balked at the potential negative impact on casinos in their communities. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Senate approved legislation Monday that aims to improve the relationship between the Department of Child Services and the state's foster parents. The measure makes several changes to the way foster parents interact with both the agency and the court system. Bill author Aaron Houchin says, for example, the legislation creates a new definition of long-term foster parent, someone who's cared for the child for at least 12 months.
So that we make sure that parents, the foster parents who've invested time and energy and care for these children have a say when it comes to intervening in CHINS cases and termination cases.
Houchin's bill also gives foster parents first priority for placement if the child returns to the child welfare system. The bill cleared the Senate unanimously and heads to the House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A State House committee plans to study carbon dioxide storage this summer. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, it's the result of changes to a bill that originally proposed making it easier for companies to inject it into the ground.
Some scientists say injecting CO2 underground could cause earthquakes or pollute drinking water. That's why the Citizens Action Coalition urged the Senate to take a closer look before making it easier for companies to acquire land for the practice. Kerwin Olson is the group's executive director.
I think the legislature did the right thing in this case by, you know, hitting the pause button and wanting to take the time to gather information.
Under the new version of the bill, a committee would study the viability of CO2 storage in Indiana and what rights and responsibilities companies that want to store it would have. The bill passed in the Senate and now moves on to the House for consideration. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The Indiana House approved the budget bill Monday along party lines. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports Republicans and Democrats argued over the two-year spending plan's so-called, quote, statement of priorities. The Indiana House approved the budget bill Monday along party lines. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports Republicans and Democrats argued over the two-year spending plan's so-called, quote, statement of priorities.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A recently launched project in Indiana trains providers across the state to properly treat HIV. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan has more.
The project comes from Indiana University's Fairbanks School of Public Health. It's one of the school's so-called ECHO projects, which stands for Extension for Community Healthcare Outcomes, designed to address healthcare access needs. Associate Dean Dr. Joan Duvey says their latest project educates providers on HIV treatment.
How do you do the testing? How do you have the conversations around testing? How do you, if you make the diagnosis, how do you provide treatment to those individuals? And how do you work with those individuals in your practice in a non-stigmatizing way?
Advances in treatment can allow people with HIV to live long, healthy lives without risk of transmission. The new ECHO project will offer free learning sessions to medical professionals twice a month. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A bill that would regulate hemp production in Indiana has passed out of the Indiana Senate. Last year, the House overwhelmingly passed a bill doing something similar, but it failed in the Senate by being turned into a summer study committee instead. Now that hemp has been removed from the federal controlled substance list, bill author Senator Randy Head says Indiana legislators need to make the state's rules.
According to the federal farm bill, states cannot come up with their own program to grow industrial hemp, and if we don't do it, the federal government will do it for us, and as always, I think Hoosiers know best and what's best for us.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A state environmental group says Indiana needs more staff to make sure its drinking water is free from contaminants like bacteria, harmful nitrates, and lead. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, it wants the state to add about $780,000 to the Indiana Department of Environmental Management's budget for a dozen more employees.
The Hoosier Environmental Council says a decade of budget cuts has left IDEM with just 48 employees to oversee the state's more than 4,000 public water systems. Indra Frank with the HEC says many of those are rural drinking water wells that serve places like churches and small schools.
Where they, you know, don't have a big staff that can keep track of the regulations and stay up to date.
And Frank says since the Environmental Protection Agency added more rules in 2014, violations increased by more than 60% in Indiana. The HEC says adding just 12 IDEM staff members could go a long way in protecting the state's drinking water. IDEM says Governor Holcomb's proposed budget meets the needs of the agency. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
State lawmakers want to give exonerated prisoners money for their wrongful incarceration. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on legislation now in the Senate after its unanimous passage by the House.
Republican Representative Greg Stuerwald says Indiana should provide exonerated prisoners an option. They can sue the state, as they can now, or take a payout from a fund created by his legislation.
They cannot do both. If they take from the fund and are eligible, they receive $50,000 for each year that they have been wrongfully incarcerated.
Stuhlwald says working with the Innocence Project, a national group that seeks to overturn wrongful convictions, current Indiana exonerees who are already suing the state will get the same option, continue with their suits or take the money paid out over 5 years. The Republican lawmakers' bill also extends to exonerees transition services the Department of Correction already offers to offenders about to be released, such as mental health and substance abuse treatment. He says the wrongfully incarcerated haven't been offered those services in the past. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
East Chicago residents are still nervous about lead and arsenic contamination. 2 years after government agencies started a large-scale cleanup that's not yet finished, residents question the use of an elementary school building in the Superfund site. The Environmental Protection Agency says the building is safe. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Thiel reports, not everyone trusts the EPA.
Less than a week before the end of summer break in 2016, the school district closed Carrie Gosch Elementary. There was lead and arsenic contaminated soil in the neighborhood and at a corner of the property. We reached Superintendent Paige McNulty through Skype.
The residents were concerned, and I would be too as a mom, about my kids walking across the soil and then coming into the building and it being on their feet, on their shoes.
2 years later, the Environmental Protection Agency says the school is safe. Though the test results haven't been published since 2017 for lead dust and 2015 for soil testing. But Pastor Don Ramirez saw the building as a chance to grow. His church, the Cross Church, had ballooned to more than 200 members.
It was just an opportunity that presented itself, and there was more space. And we were running out of room at our current location, and we took the opportunity.
Environmental Protection Agency says only a small portion of the site has high levels of contamination, and it plans to clean that up in the spring. As for the building itself, the EPA told Pastor Ramirez it's safe.
So I made sure of all those things before we moved into this location. I wasn't going to put people at risk.
But many residents in East Chicago don't trust the EPA. There's evidence it knew about the lead contamination as far back as the 1980s. But agencies told residents not to worry. That is, until a state report showed several children had high levels of lead in their blood. So when the EPA says that the Cross Church's members will be safe, some residents have doubts. Residents like Clemae Bullock. She's a teacher and co-organizer for the group Calumet Lives Matter.
There should not be children there in that building in the way it's currently being used.
And Bullock says if the building is safe, why wasn't it opened up to let the community decide what's to be done with it? Many residents would like to see recent EPA test results for lead and arsenic at Carrie Gosch, but the school district decides who can see them and didn't respond to our requests for the data.
It is unclear when the last time testing has been done at that property.
That's Debbie Chisower, an attorney with Northwestern University Law School who represents residents affected by the USS lead site. We reached her through Skype. She says when the EPA demolished the nearby contaminated public housing complex, lead and arsenic could have spread to the Carrie Gosch property. Chisower says as the EPA continues to dig up contaminated soil in the area,
there's nothing that prevents contaminated materials from blowing from that site over to the Gosch property.
At a public meeting in November, the EPA's Doug Velotti says the agency does have protections to make sure the contamination doesn't spread, and it will test along the way.
Yeah, we've got protections that we have planned, very similar to what happened when they actually did the demolition of the housing project.
The company that monitored the contamination at the demolition site of the West Calumet housing complex, Americo Engineering, says there were no detectable levels of lead, arsenic, or asbestos in the air during that time. The Cross Church pastor Don Ramirez says he believes the EPA and is ready to move on.
Philippians chapter 3, verse 12 to 16, I press forward. If one thing I have done, I have apprehended what's in front of me.
What can we do to make a difference, to keep moving forward and making Chicago a great place, because that's what it is. It's a great community.
The EPA declined to be interviewed about the Cross Church. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
Because they didn't care about the land flowing with milk and honey. They didn't care about how God was blessing them. They didn't care. All they were worried about was where they used to be.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The opioid crisis has hit American communities hard. States have responded by creating databases to keep track of prescriptions so people can't go from doctor to doctor for more drugs. In fact, every state except one, Missouri, has a comprehensive database. As Side Effects Public Media's Sebastian Martinez Valdivia reports, that may change soon.
About 15 miles southwest of St. Louis is Fenton City Park. It's pretty unremarkable, with picnic shelters, softball fields, and flags waving gently from a memorial to fallen soldiers. This is where Kevin Mullane sought refuge as he struggled with an opioid addiction.
Anybody that knew Kevin knew he loved them, Park.
Kevin's mom, Kathy Arbini, struggles to hold back tears as she describes how he became increasingly isolated. Mullane turned to prescription opioids to deal with depression. He eventually started stealing medications from friends and family members and doctor shopping for more.
He went to this doctor for a backache, and then he went to this doctor for a footache, and then he went to this doctor because he was depressed. And so he had all these doctors working against each other.
In November of 2009, at the age of 21, Mullane died of a heroin overdose in a friend's basement. Arbini says at the time he had 9 prescriptions from different doctors. But there was no statewide program then to keep track, and the deaths continue. In 2017, 951 Missourians died from opioid overdoses. At the state capitol, which is being renovated, House Bill 188 is the latest effort to create a program to track opioids and other prescription drugs across Missouri. It's sponsored by Republican State Representative Holly Rader, and it's her 6th attempt.
I'm absolutely concerned that it might not make it through this year, but I'm more hopeful than ever.
In the past, the main opposition has come from within Rader's own party, and one man in particular. Senator Rob Schaff filibustered the bills, saying they infringed on patients' privacy rights.
I'm someone who's very concerned about privacy as well, and I don't like government databases. But this is very much different than that. It's a medical tool.
But Schaff ran up against a term limit last year. Supporters also hope to get some leverage from a drug monitoring program started in the St. Louis area in 2017. It was largely created to sidestep the years of gridlock in the Senate. More than 70 jurisdictions have joined, but it doesn't reach more than 50 others. Family-owned Sam's Health Mart is in Randolph County, one of the places that hasn't joined the St. Louis program. That means pharmacist Annie Eisenbeiss has to take matters into her own hands.
So if I suspect that potentially somebody is abusing or misusing the medication, I will call all of the neighboring pharmacies. So in Moberly specifically, we have 5 other pharmacies, but then we'll call different counties just to double check.
Eisenbeiss says a statewide program wouldn't single-handedly solve Missouri's opioid problem, but it would help. She says someone came to her recently with almost identical prescriptions from 2 different doctors.
Luckily, he handed them both to me at the pharmacy, and I was like, these are the same thing. If you take both of them, you're going to overdose.
She says a statewide drug database would flag prescriptions so providers can avoid similar scenarios. Some researchers say the monitoring programs can have a chilling effect on providers, leading them to prescribe fewer opioids and pushing people towards more dangerous options like heroin. Arbini remains a supporter. After Kevin died, she became an activist and testified before the legislature on the database bills.
I was so nervous. I remember being so nervous but so proud because I told Kevin's story.
She'd like to open a treatment clinic and has a reason to keep pushing for a solution. Kevin's 9-year-old son, her grandson.
He looks like our son and he acts like him, and I'll be honest, it scares me too. But his mom is aware of it. We're very close. So we watch him, and hopefully he won't go down that same path.
For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Sebastian Martinez Valdivia.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
The CDC reports nearly 160 cases of measles have been confirmed in 10 states since the start of this year. Five of those cases are in Illinois, where Jessica Barnes lives. Her five-year-old daughter, Peyton, is undergoing chemotherapy for leukemia. Barnes spoke with Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman about what concerns her most about the measles outbreak.
When she goes through chemo treatment, that makes her vulnerable to getting sick from even the littlest things. Even something like a cold can be really tough. Can you describe what that's like for Peyton?
Yes. So a lot of people don't understand it's not the cancer that makes her susceptible to sickness, but it is the chemo. The chemo wipes out the cancer cells, but it also wipes out all of her cells. Good, bad, it can't tell the difference. A infant has a stronger immune system than her. When her counts are at zero, she is considered neutropenic, and that means even certain fruits and vegetables with their natural bacteria could get her sick. A common cold can turn into the flu. She can't be exposed to a lot of people, so she can't go to school. She can't go to the grocery store. And with this measles outbreak, it's really scary, because now I absolutely can't take her anywhere.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. So there have been four measles cases in the past month in Champaign-Urbana, including one in the preschool where your daughter occasionally attends. And so what has that been like for you as a mother to be in this situation right now?
I'm terrified. She only goes to school periodically, and it's just to boost her spirits, because having a five-year-old just trapped in the house all the time, and she just wants to be a kid. She wants to go to school and play with her friends and see her teacher. She was invited that week to go to the Valentine's Day party, and I work nights, so luckily I was too tired to bring her. But that's a very real possibility that she would be in a hospital bed right now if I would have took her for a Valentine's Day party.
The school notified you that there had been a child?
Yes.
Who was attending, who had measles?
I got a recording Saturday morning saying that a child in afternoon class, the same class she attends, had measles the week of February 11th.
But thankfully she wasn't in contact with that student.
Yes.
She wasn't at school
that
week.
She didn't go to school.
Yeah.
I mean, for her, if she was to get measles, it would take her months to recover. If her body was in a state that she could recover, it would mean that she would have to stop her chemotherapy treatments, which means the cancer could come back. And it would mean that all the months of chemo and all the months of the hospital stays would have been for nothing.
So what would you say to a parent who says, I'm not going to vaccinate my children, even when they don't have a medical reason to be avoiding vaccines?
I would tell them, I have spent months by my daughter's hospital bed when she couldn't eat, when she couldn't walk because of her treatments. And it's not a sight that a parent wants to see, to feel so helpless. And it seems very selfish to put other people's children at risk. My daughter is vulnerable. I can't get her vaccinated because she's fighting a bigger monster. And I would ask them to think about that. When they choose not to get these vaccines, you know, there's proven science behind it. This measles outbreak is completely unnecessary. And now my daughter's life is at risk, and not because of cancer, but because you chose not to vaccinate.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson. As soon as longtime professional photographer Q2 Luong heard that President Trump had signed the bill and created Indiana Dunes National Park, he literally stopped the presses on the second edition of his book, Treasured Lands, A Photographic Odyssey Through America's National Parks, and hopped on a plane to come to the region. While in Northwest Indiana last week, he spoke with Lakeshore Public Radio's Sharon Jackson about his trip and his impression of the now Indiana Dunes National Park.
When you heard that Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore became Indiana Dunes National Park, what was your reaction?
I was very surprised because I'd been following the bill for years, actually, and I noticed that it died in the 115th Congress, and then I saw that it had been reintroduced in January in the 116th Congress, but those things usually they take months just to get out of committee, so I didn't expect it to pass that fast. So that was, I saw it on social media, a picture of the rangers posing with a cardboard sign saying park, and I was totally surprised.
What tipped you off that this was even going on, that there were discussions about turning Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore into Indiana Dunes National Park?
I've been following it for years, actually, because I have this record of being the first to photograph each of the 58 national parks. And then when there was the 59th national park, I followed it and I was the first to get there to photograph it. And I did the same for the 60th national park, which is Gateway Arch National Park, which just came last year. So I've been keeping track of it. That's what I do.
Why did you want to be the first to photograph the national parks?
It's just that that I had this this record. I saw it. It was fun to do it. And here I had another circumstance which made me come here as soon as I could. I released a book for the Centennial of the National Park Service, which is called Treasured Lands. And so over 2 years and 2 months, it sold out of free printing. So I was pretty eager to have a new printing out. And it would be a new edition, actually, because it would have one more national park. So I wanted it to be up to date. So the book had been at the printer for about a month. It was going to be printed. But when I heard about the new designation, I had to call my printer to literally stop the presses so that I could update the book. But in order not to delay the book, I had also to do that trip as soon as I could.
So why is it important for you to be the first?
I'm saying it's a project that I've been doing for 25 years now to photograph the national parks. And, it makes it a bit more special if in addition, I come before others.
How is Indiana Dunes National Park compared to the other ones? Is there any differences that you've noticed or anything of note from your eye?
Yeah, it's very different, I would say, from most of the park. And I would consider it to be an exception because it's the land area is pretty small. And then I think it's maybe the fourth smallest national park or something like that. And in addition, the land is kind of broken up, right? It's mixed with a state park, with private lands, with industry, which is just at the doorstep of the park. So I think that's really quite different from the other parks. So it's more like an urban park. So, but at the same time, the thing which is interesting is that also it has all this development. There's still a lot of natural diversity in the park. And if you remember, natural diversity is what drew me to the national park in the first place.
Do you think it deserves the recognition that it's gotten to be designated a national park?
It's difficult to say because I think indeed by the criteria of large area of land, I would say not quite. Some of the proponents' argument is that now these parks, which are even smaller, for instance, they designated Gateway Arch as a national park last year, right? And when Gateway Arch National Park came about, I was a bit worried that it was kind of setting up a precedent now that they have this area which is tiny and which is a city park. And I do have the feeling that, the national park, they used to be the most special areas in the country. Mm-hmm. And if I would say all the areas, now they begin to vie for that designation, and now they are no longer the most special places, then it's going to dilute a bit the label national park. And it is a worry. And in some sense, it is possible that it would have been better for not to add a park that some people might consider underserving. On the other hand, I understand, you know, that that people in this area are very passionate about this place, you know, and I mean, I'm really happy for them that they feel that the area got the recognition that they feel they deserve. Okay, so I heard that the park has actually a lot of biodiversity, so there's much more than meets the eye. So when you go around, you know, the scenery, most of the places here do not look extremely spectacular, you know, like Yosemite or Yellowstone. And so in terms of scenery, it's not in the same league. We have to be frank about that. But on the other hand, I read that the park has maybe the fourth most plant species of any national park, which is something which is special, I suppose. Also, I mean, it's more of scientific interest than of interest to the casual visitor, but it's still there, I would say. So it reminds me a bit, you know, of some in some sense of Acadia, in the sense that it's a smaller area, but it does pack a lot of things, you know. So as we mentioned, we have the lake shore, the dunes, the wetlands, the forest. So I would say why not? That wouldn't be my choice necessarily, but I'm happy that it did get some recognition.
For Lakeshore Public Radio, I'm Sharon Jackson.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's Regionally Speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Tammy Silverman from the Indiana Youth Institute.
The Indiana Youth Institute puts out its Kids Count Data Book. In fact, the 25th anniversary edition of the Kids Count Data Book has just come out. It's an opportunity to be able to see how the status of Indiana's children and youth is. And there's always some very serious questions and things to bring up, but it also helps spur along a lot of discussion and conversation out in the communities as well, too. Let's check in with Tammy Silverman, who's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, the IYI, about the latest Kids Count data book. And Tammy, thank you for joining us today on Regionally Speaking.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, let's go through the general explanation first about what the Kids Count book is, the data book's all about here. Many people probably heard this reference, but they don't really understand how it comes together, the information that you all at the IYI gather to be able to put this thing together, and then what in turn it's going to be able to do in general terms for kind of pushing the conversation along on ways to help Indiana's youth.
Absolutely. So again, like you said, for 25 years, we've been pulling together information with the idea that for us to be able to really help kids, we need to have some current accurate data on how they're faring. And so we pull together information from a lot of the different state agencies. So the Department of Education, the Department of Children's Services, the Department of Corrections, you know, all of those things, public health, as well as many other sources that have been vetted and, you know, are tested for reliability and all those kinds of things. So we pull all that together, and then we really go through and put it in, hopefully, an order that folks find usable. So it's broken down into four categories: family and community, economic well-being, education, and health. And it looks at those areas across the state of Indiana.
I know that a lot of this work is really just putting data together, but I would imagine, as you just mentioned here, that there are a lot of various places where it is available out there, and the average person is not going to be able to check out every single source and put things together. So this brings things together in one easy-to-understand piece, does it not?
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, when we started doing this 25 years ago, they said it wasn't that easy to get it. You know, you couldn't just hop on the computer and search data. And the reality is you can now, but just as you said, sometimes it's really hard to track down. It's really hard to know what's the most current resources, and it's really hard to get some of those different points together. So by pulling it all together, we're hoping, and we often hear great feedback, that people do find it a source that they can use for all kinds of different things.
Mm-hmm.
Most commonly, you know, nonprofits use it to raise funds and to justify and get some of their grants. And then our policymakers, we were just at the State House a couple of days ago, and they said they use it a lot to inform new legislative policies or administrative policies.
I know a lot of people probably, especially new lawmakers, may or may not be familiar with some of the details of some of this, and they're focusing primarily on the bigger picture, and sometimes they probably need a little help in understanding these things.
They do. And they're eager to get it. I will say we're spending several days this month at the State House doing what we're calling data and donuts and setting up between the two chambers and, you know, provide really those county snapshots. A lot of our elected leaders want to know not only the state information, but what exactly is happening in their area of the state that they represent. And then we can also custom data requests. So, for example, if there's a senator or representative that is involved in a particular bill, say on education or on juvenile justice, we can drill down with them on that data to provide them the most current information so that they can take that into their committee hearings.
Okay, Tammy, let's go into a little more detail here, and we'll take a look at data from Lake and from Porter counties in particular here. We know that to be able to improve the well-being of children and youth in the state as well as in Northwest Indiana, you have to first understand the current reality. Let's talk about what the current reality seems to be on the topic of family and community.
Family and community, we know that one of the most critical issues here is the number of children who live with someone that has a problem with drugs or alcohol. And again, that takes into account the opioid crisis, and we've seen that impact on kids. The national average is 8.5%, and in Indiana, we're a little higher than that with 9.2%. So that equates to one out of every 11 children. And so again, this is something that we're looking at as well as in family and community. It looks at the number of children, the abuse rates for abuse and neglect. And unfortunately, in your area, that has gone up over the last 3 years from about 12% to right at about 20%. Mm-hmm. That is very consistent with the state average. So it has gone up, but it's not, you know, it's not any worse relative to the state.
On the issue of economic well-being, I know that there's very serious concern because there are many young people out there that are in families that are well below, in some cases, the economic threshold, and they're trying to deal with life as a young person, and on top of that, in a family that may not have enough money to be able to keep enough food on the table or a proper place to stay.
You're right. And as many of us know, raising a child does take some financial resources and can be expensive in many families. We know that the unemployment rates throughout the state have gone down significantly over the past 3 years. One of the things that we're digging into and looking at is to what extent do those jobs provide enough financial resources. So we have a lot of folks that are underemployed, right, or that maybe those jobs aren't providing a living wage. And so, again, in order to have the resources to provide for kids, we need to look at, are those jobs the most productive financially, right? Mm-hmm. And so we know, again, in your area, the median household income has gone up over the last 3 years and is fairly consistent with the state average. The unemployment rates have gone down. And fortunately, it looks like there's a small decrease in the number of children living in poverty. So that, again, is going in the right direction. It is a little higher than the state average.
Now, how about housing costs? Because that's always part of it, too. If a family has to really scrape money together to be able to feed a family and take care of the family, some of that comes into whether they can find a comfortable place to live.
Right. And comparatively, Indiana is a fairly inexpensive place to live.
Yeah.
And again, that varies greatly from community to community and area to area. But overall, we are placed 10th nationally for the lowest housing costs. So again, you know, relative to other states and living where you all do, that part of the state, there's a lot of comparisons to Illinois. We're relatively inexpensive for housing costs.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman with the Indiana Youth Institute, taking a look at some of the information out of the 2019, the 25th anniversary edition of the Kids Count Data Book. On the subject of education, where do we seem to stand on that here across the state and here in Northwest Indiana?
Actually, education is our bright spot as far as the state goes. That overall child well-being in Indiana, we're ranked 28th in the country. For education, we're actually ranked 14th. And so what we're seeing and one of the biggest factors there is our 4th and 8th graders and their standardized tests in math and reading compared to their peers nationally. In your area, one of the really great pieces of news coming out of the data book is the fact that the number of high-quality early childhood care and education programs has more than doubled.
Wow.
In the last 3 years. So that's not to say that it's meeting all the needs that are out there, but again, there's been significant progress. And so, again, I think that if you talk to the teachers, if we talk to the educators that are out there, they would certainly say we still have room to go to make sure all the educational needs of our kids are being met. But in general, this has been an area that we've seen the most progress over the past 5 years.
Do we seem to find it particularly here in Lake County, because it's one of the counties that has set up with the pre-K program? Are we doing very well for the very youngest people, but to get them off out of the home basically and into the classroom?
You bet. And that's exactly right. That's where we're seeing a lot of uptick. And we know that that access to those high-quality early childhood experiences pays off in the long run. So you guys are moving in the right direction, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of hope out there as far as what that means for the future continued success.
Now, obviously, the last category that's within the Kids Count data book deals with health. That's always the major concern, I know, for Hoosier young people and the family members as well, too. And I guess that's one of the areas we're probably working the hardest to try to correct, is it not?
It is. And so, unfortunately, health is one of our biggest challenge areas. We're ranked, Indiana as a whole is ranked 31st. Nationally, when we look at prenatal care, we're doing all right. We're ranked 15th nationally, but the areas of biggest challenge are infant mortality and the number of children with health insurance. This also takes into account what the ratio is of access to mental health providers. And so, again, I think there's been a lot of discussion about infant mortality. We know that infants are more likely to die in their first year in Indiana than those in 42 other states. And when you break that down, Black infants are additionally more than twice as likely to die before their first baby than white infants mm-hmm. in Indiana. And so that is a critical issue that I know they're trying to address at the state level, but that is important for us all to pay attention to.
Are we finding, too, that when you get the children getting older, they're into past elementary school, into middle school or high school, you have the concerns, I guess, about their mental health as well as their physical health, don't you?
Absolutely. And so, again, one of the bright spots of news for your folks is the fact that ratio of mental health providers has actually improved significantly over the past 3 years. So it used to be 1 to every 749 individuals. Now it's 1 to 630. So again, that's still a huge caseload, but it's much better than the state average. One of our areas that we continue to look at is, unfortunately, Indiana ranks second in the nation for the percentage of our teens who have contemplated or attempted suicide.
Oh,
and so we know that there's a correlation between that access to mental health provision, anxiety, and that risk factor for our kids.
Well, not only do we talk here about the data, looking statewide as well as here in Northwest Indiana, that's in the latest Kids Count data book. Recommendations, I guess, doesn't specifically call for recommendations for policymakers to look at, but obviously you want to nudge them in the right direction. What kinds of things does the IYI recommend that community leaders as well as legislative leaders do to try to make some improvement in some of these numbers?
Yep, you've got it. So really, the data is only as good as what we do with it, right? You know, we want to have accurate data. We want to have up-to-date data. But it's really about what do we do with it now, going forward. And so throughout the data book, for each one of these big sections, there are some recommendations. And there are recommendations for state leaders that are looking at policy, but also community leaders and also individuals, right? We can all play a role in improving the well-being of our kids. And so I would just encourage folks to take a look there and see where what issues are important to them and then what role they can play in helping increase the well-being of Indiana kids. Because we know for those of us who grew up here and who had, good experiences as a child, we know that it's a possibility. It's possible for a child in Indiana to have a wonderful childhood. Unfortunately, we just don't have that yet for all of our kids, so there's more work to be done.
And we kind of mentioned it at the beginning of our conversation here about the fact that the information is all gathered together from the various sources. It's part of the 2019 Kids Count data book. If anybody would like to find out more, and particularly kind of drill down into the particular county data, which you can do too, it's all on IYI.org, is it not?
It is. And so everything is available. at your fingertip both the entirety of the book as well as all the 92 county snapshots. In addition, if you still come up with questions, right, we have a data team that's available to have those conversations with you or a community group, right? If you want to have a conversation about why your community is ranked in a particular way in a particular category, we are more than happy to have those conversations.
I mean, sometimes we forget, too, that the IYI has staffers that branch out to various parts of the state, including Northwest Indiana, and they're more than happy to talk with organizations. You say about community groups that maybe have questions and the like. You can bring up some of this information, and you can have these conversations in a smaller group or a big room, whichever you choose, I guess, to talk about these issues.
Absolutely right. We will do about 40 presentations on this data book throughout the state over the next couple of months, everything from church groups to Rotary clubs to school corporations. Melanie Walker is the representative in your area, and she would be more than happy to have a discussion and get one of those presentations set up if that's of interest.
And as we say, you can always go to IYI.org, IYI.org, and find out more information. Look at the individual sections of data here, not only about Northwest Indiana, but the rest of the state as a whole. And as always, Tammy, thank you for spending time with us to give us a good overview of what the current, the 25th anniversary Indiana Youth Institute Kids Count data book has to say. And let's hope that some of the information, if it hasn't already, that shocks enough people into some action.
Thank you so much, Chris. We always appreciate your passion for helping Indiana's kids.
Tammy Silverman is the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.